Okay, so I sent you a mail about a possible extra class where we'll be discussing, I think, information extraction, which I would start talking about today, and I'll continue in tomorrow's class. This is the last I've seen, I guess, basically by a small whisker, the morning slot seems to have more people. It's 8 plus 3, 11. So it would be from 10:30 to 11:45. I am still trying to get the room. I'll let you guys know by email which room it would be, but it would be in the morning on Friday. And I'll try to get it recorded for the people who can't make it. They just have to make it up that way. Yes?
So the stuff that you cover will still be on the final?
Yes. Yes. If I speak, it's on the final. No, I'm sorry. yeah. But you would have a recording. What else? Okay. We were talking about XML and meaning last time, and so this is basically, we realized that it's a syntactic standard and that we need basically additional mechanisms to provide meaning, okay, for the tags. Okay, so, and in some sense, there are two different ways that meaning can be provided. One is manually, in which case you are doing semantic web standards. And then, so I will start with the semantic web standards first, and then we will then talk about information extraction as a way of partially automating that. Okay, so the bigger thing you want to get out of this discussion is how this interest in finding and exploiting structure is defining much of what's happening in the current information retrieval mining integration area. Okay, basically if you look at the WWW, the World Wide Web Conference, many papers would be about semantic web, many papers would be about information extraction. Okay, because that's like one of the hard things that's still going on. And so you want to understand why, you know, obviously I hope by now you understood that finding structure, I mean, using structure is a great way to improve querying. I mean, I mentioned that many, many times, but, you know, it should not be too surprising for you by now. And so there's a lot of interest in either having it specified and using it. And to specify the structure, you need to develop standards which will allow people to specify the structure, okay? Or you would automatically learn the structure, which is information extraction, okay? So let me start with an example, and then that sort of puts hopefully everything in perspective, because we'll also come back to that example in information extraction, okay? So here is some text. It says, Rama was the son of King Dasharatha. He had three brothers. He married Sita. Ramayana tells the story of Rama's quest to rescue Sita when she is abducted by Ravana. That's the text, okay? Now, if I have access to that text, it turns out that Ramayana, by the way, you know, half the people here, more than half the people in this room already know what I'm talking about. Ramayana is one of the two main epics of Hinduism. And, you know, there is Rama trying to kill Ravana, who has 10 heads, and all that fun stuff. But anyway, so if you are a machine, okay, then this is just a bunch of text, okay. So what can you answer with respect to this text? Well, if I have a query like Rama Sita, then I can check whether this file has those keywords. That's what IR querying is going to help you support, okay. Now, obviously, even those of you who don't know anything about, you know, how Ravana looked, not that the guy who drew this picture knew how Ravana looked, but, you know, those of you who don't know anything about how Rama and Ravana looked can read this and understand a lot more than saying, okay, this file will be relevant if you are looking for Rama and Sita. For example, if I ask you, tell me all the people. Oh my God, you can't read this carefully, but, you know, well, but tell me all the people that Rama was married to. Tell me all the people that Rama was married to. Okay. Now, you know, turns out that Rama is not from Utah-Arizona border and basically only has one wife, it turns out. Okay. But you don't know who that wife is. Okay. The point is, if to be able to answer this question, this is more of a database style question. So you are hoping that there are a bunch of couples explaining, you know, the marriage relation between bunches of people, and then you are trying to select, you know, the people who are married to Rama. Okay? Again, I'm putting this in English, but this is really a relation. It's a table married, which is a two attribute table, and you are trying to bind one of the attributes to Rama and getting the values for the other attribute. Okay? To be able to answer this question, first of all, you have to realize that this cannot be answered by normal IR techniques. You need to somehow have gone from here to something like this. Okay? You need to have represented this English somehow in like a format which shows the relational structure of this, you know, narrative. So for example, married Rama Sita, son of Dasharatha Rama, abducts Ravana Sita, rescues Rama Sita. Okay? Fine? Now, the question is, if people have written this in English and they meant it to be used by other people who understand English, presumably. Okay? So if I can ask you the question, you can answer me this question. Okay? But I'm going to ask the machine, the mediator, the question. And that mediator needs access to this knowledge because it doesn't quite know how to go from here to answering this question. The big first question is, how do I write this? Given this, how do I get this? There are two ways of doing this. One is we hope that whoever wrote this also wanted machines to be able to reason with this. And so they put these annotations on top of the file. So this is your English view, and you do view source, there will be a bunch of these kinds of statements. Now, many of you can see that this is just simple predicate logic statements, ground predicate logic statements. Okay, this is a predicate, these are the, you know, objects for which that predicate, that relation is holding. Okay, so if you remember 471, or if you ever learned logic, this is just the base facts in some logical theory. Okay, if those base facts are somehow, you know, put into this English, and you guys can read this and realize these base facts exist, but a machine doesn't, and you need to be able to tell the machine what those facts are. Now, if I'm sitting there to give some, basically, if I'm willing, you know, I wrote this file, I'm willing to give this information also as part of the file. What standard should I use to specify this? I need a standard for specifying base logic facts. Okay, what would be a reasonable standard? Generate an XML standard. Okay, generate an XML standard for writing logical facts. Okay, that's not too hard. You just have to say predicate begin, the name of the predicate, predicate end, object 1 begin, the name of the object 1 end, object 2 begin, name of the object 2 end. Okay, now, obviously, this, it turns out, actually, is RDF standard. The easiest way to understand, many of you have probably heard of RDF. Some of you must have probably heard of RDF. RDF is the resource description framework, and essentially the best way to understand that is to say it's an XML syntax for writing base level logical facts. Notice that it doesn't need to be particularly complicated because all logical facts will be of this kind of a form, you know, relation followed by a bunch of objects. So it just needs to say relation followed by object 1, object 2, etc. In fact, we'll see in a minute that RDF goes out of its way to make its life simple. It assumes all the relations are binary relations. Okay? So in fact, RDF assumes relation, so basically it assumes here is object 1, relation object 2. If it's a binary relation, then you get to think of the relation, it becomes a simple graph over objects. Okay, now we will talk about what if you have actually ternary relations. If you have n-ary relation, how can you write it as a binary relation? It turns out you can do that. It's not too hard. Okay? So, RDF is basically a standard for writing base facts, and the specific RDF standard that is currently being used essentially supports binary facts writing. That just removes all the magic out of RDF. The whole point I'm trying to do here is there is some syntax. It looks ugly when you look at RDF standard. It has basically some XML syntax that people agreed upon to specify the predicate name, specify the object names. Okay? But eventually, it really is just a standard for writing base facts. Okay? Now, that already is one step ahead. Okay? As long as we are here, I'll come back to this and say, suppose people are not willing to write the structure. I want to write a program that will somehow go from here to here. What would that program be doing? That would be doing information extraction. So information extraction and the semantic web are basically competing techniques for going from here to here. In one case, the human is providing you the information in some format. In another case, you write programs which you can read this and write this. Okay, so I'll first talk about the semantic web thing, and then I'll come back to information extraction. Okay, next. This is fine. Yes. Keep quiet. I'm sorry. What I mean is, keep that question to yourself for just a second. Okay, these are base facts. These are base facts. Nothing more is said. You have to think of these as a particular relation name and the object 1, object 2. That's all you know right now. You actually understand English meanings of these. Okay? Really what your machine understands in those is that R1, object 1, object 2. That's basically what it's understanding. Okay, so the very question that you're asking is basically related to this. Suppose I ask now, who is the spouse of Rama? Okay, or I ask, who is father of Rama? All of you here can answer that. Right? You don't know anything about Hinduism, but you understood this English piece of text, and you can answer that question. Okay, an equivalent example I have, if you are not into Ramayana, is the explorer Magellan went around the world 3 times. Okay, and one of his trips he died. Which trip did he die? Many of you probably don't know anything about explorers and Magellan, etc. But you already know the answer. Where is the answer in what I said? It's not there in what I said. It's there in the background knowledge that you have about death and trips. Death is the last trip you get to make. Okay? If you take a dead person around the world, we don't say that they are making extra trips. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay, so this question of who is spouse of Rama, who is father of Rama, if you are unable to answer this, then I can actually say you didn't understand the text. Okay? If after hearing the Magellan story, if you're unable to answer which trip Magellan died, it's reasonable for me to say that you are clueless. In fact, in the language that I spoke when I, in my mother tongue, and some people here might actually be able to read this. I don't know if anybody here is. But it just says, the way to say somebody is truly clueless is to say, Ramayana Mantavini Ramudiki Sita Amountendi Annattu, which basically means, this guy heard the entire story of Ramayana and asked, what is the relation between Sita and Rama? That basically means you're completely clueless. You read the whole thing and you didn't understand any, you did not, you are unable to make any inferences from the text. Okay? So, notice where we are going from. From here, all we wanted was find the file which has these words. Here you are saying, is a particular relation holding. Here you are saying, can I make inferences over the relation? To be able to support inferences like this, okay, think about, just think about what do you need to have in the back of your head which makes you answer that Magellan question. What? No. Many of you basically, I hope there's nobody here who's still thinking which trip did Magellan die in. Okay? And to the extent you all figured out what the answer is, I'm not going to tell you. This is going to be a quiz question. And this is actually a good way of telling, you know, humans from machines, right? And in fact, by the way, CAPTCHAs, the newer versions of CAPTCHAs are essentially doing these kinds of inferences techniques. So they'll give you a piece of text, they'll ask you a question. The assumption is, unless you are a human, you may not be able to answer this. Why? Because what's called common sense is huge amount of background shallow knowledge that we all hold in our head. A four-year-old can answer this Magellan question. Okay, but expert systems good at being able to diagnose your internal medical disorder may still not know the answer to that. Okay, the bigger question is, exactly how did you figure out, if you introspect, how did you figure out that Magellan died in a particular trip? Did you have background knowledge saying, if Magellan died, he would have been dead in the third trip? I'm giving you the answer. Okay, did you have that kind of a knowledge? Did you have the knowledge saying, when explorers go around the world, they die on the last trip? Is that the knowledge you have? Did you have a knowledge saying, Spanish people, when they go around the world, die on the last trip? Did you say that after death, you don't do anything? Trip is doing something. Okay? And so, if you're dead, you could not have made any more trips. Which is the way you represented your language knowledge? Most likely the last one. To be able to say that last one, it's not just enough to be able to extract stuff from the text. What you need is additional background knowledge about these relations. Suppose my human who was willing to write this RDF was also going to write this stuff. So they would write now no longer just simple base facts, they would at least write full first-order logical sentences. For example, I did not even write for all xy, but here, for all xy, son of xy means parent of yx. If you are somebody's son, then that person is your parent. Okay? And if you are married to xy, if x and y are married, then x is the spouse of y, and y is the spouse of x. This is just a very small fragment of knowledge that you just know about the world you live in. Your machine doesn't. Okay? So suppose for this file, I want to provide this information. If I provide this, you can, using simple logical inference techniques, answer this question. Right? Now, saying simple logical inference techniques should make the 471 people feel worried. Because it turns out that logical inference in first order logic is semi-decidable. That means if there is an answer to your question, you can find it before the universe ends. Okay? If there is no answer to the question, the universe might end and you may still not be able to find that answer. So it's a truly, horrendously complex problem. Okay? However, at least there is a way of talking about inference over those sentences. From our point of view, what we are interested in is, remember, we developed a language, a XML syntax for stating facts of this form. I now need an XML syntax for entire first-order logic. Not just the base-level facts, but something more like this. For historical reasons, this has been this domain knowledge. So this is called the front base facts. This is the domain knowledge or the background knowledge. For historical reasons, they have been separated out. In the semantic web standards, there is RDF, which is to provide this information, So I'm dying to give you this information, but we need to agree on a standard of communication. That's all RDFA is going to do. Okay? And this one, all our RDF schema allows you to provide this kind of knowledge to your, annotate your page with this. Remember, the nice thing about this whole thing is, since we are talking about this being a web file, okay, notice that one of the things about common sense knowledge is that a problem with humans, and in fact, and I find this all the time, the simplest, most efficient way to teach you stuff, instead of wasting all our times, you know, every semester, you know, going on, teaching the same thing, is in the beginning of the semester, you come and leave your brain with me for a day, okay? And then I just lobotomize it and put in the stuff corresponding to this course, and I'll return it to you next day. For a day, you can get along without your brain, right? So that's like the most efficient way to teach people. But lobotomy is a problem, because I think human subjects and all that fun stuff will get in, you know, NSF will kill me. Okay, so we are forced to teach by talking, which is a very inefficient way to teach. Okay, for computer programs, on the other hand, you know, so every four-year-old has to learn everything about the world all by herself or himself. If on the other hand, you figured out how to write down the entire common sense knowledge that a four-year-old knows into a computer readable form, and you wrote it for one computer, does the second computer program has to learn it all from scratch? No. Just open it, pour this in. I mean, that's exactly what you're doing. You know, you'll put it on the BitTorrent, right? And then illegally copy everybody's common knowledge yourself. And you'll be done. Do you understand what I'm saying? So in a way, we are this carbon-based life forms. We are sort of, you know, we can't eat pizza by email, and we cannot learn by lobotomy. Okay? Whereas our machines, on the other hand, can do all of this. I mean, they don't need to even eat, actually. That's a good thing. Okay? So the good thing about this is, if I were to write this kind of ontology about parent-child relationships in one place, in this standard, any file which needs that ontology can put a link to it. That's it. They don't even need to copy over. They'll put a link, and there's an infrastructure which can just download it on demand. And then you will run a logical inference system on top of it. Yes? It depends on, you can talk about the ontology into pieces, first of all. Okay? You may or you may not want to download it. And in fact, I can always, for example, state, you know, what I could say is, I could have written some story about the prawns in District 9, okay? And they will have their own crazy relationships. And I might have put a link to the human relations and connect the prawn relations to human relations. You might say, prawn 1, you know, has the whatever, X relation to prawn 2, if it's sort of like saying they're married in human relations. In which case, I am writing the ontology for prawns, okay? And then I'm also making a connection to the human ontology on which it's being written up. Okay? So this, really, writing this is writing this kind of information. There is a standard. Again, the specifics of the standards are almost less important. If you are sitting down to write it, you need to know it. What matters is getting rid of the magic surrounding these standards. All they are doing is RDF is doing this. All and RDF schema are doing this. That's it. Okay? For the rest of the next 15-20 minutes, I'll go through some examples of how RDF statements look like and the specific design choices they made in, you know, making that standard, and how the all RDF schema standard looks like. So just as RDF, it turns out, was only supporting binary relations, as I told you, RDF schema only supports a particular fragment of full first order logic called description logic, where description logics essentially tend to think in terms of classes of objects and class-subclass relationships. It turns out you can write description logic as a first order logic. But not everything that can be said in first order logic can be naturally said in description logic. And again, semantic web folks, the people who came up with these standards thought, it's enough to allow binary statements for base facts, and it's enough to allow description logic statements for the background knowledge. Just a second. And in fact, the fact that they haven't yet figured out what's the right level to go to, the semantic web folks, is made clear by the fact that for a while, this standard used to be called RDF schema. Okay, which actually is a really bad name, because XML schema is to XML, that name would make you think that XML schema is to XML what RDF schema is to RDF. That's not at all true. Not even a little bit true. RDF schema is background knowledge over the base facts. XML schema is the grammar of the XML file. Okay. Now, the specific RDF schema standard turned out did not even have enough of an expressiveness for description logics, and so now they have this standard called OWL, O-W-L, okay, which is a slightly more expressive standard, and that's what is used to make the statements about the background knowledge. Now, you might be sitting here and thinking, who in their right mind would write this stuff anyway, so I don't want to do semantic web, and that's fine with me, okay? But if you are into writing this information, you have, and there's an infrastructure, you know, which could use that information as long as you use the right standards. Yes, sir?
I've just done a lot of web development. I've never seen people write. Is this common? Like, what scenario?
This is all of semantic web view of the world. Okay? If you provide this kind of information, then you can do more useful inference over the information in the pages. Yes, I'll give you an example. It can be thrown in as part of the header, for example. Okay? So that's semantic web for you. Okay? So semantic web standards, RDF and RDF schema all are together. So what we want a standard is, we want a standard for writing the base facts, and we want a standard for writing the background knowledge. This one is RDF, this is RDF schema. Okay? So the RDF standard essentially uses a triple. You know, those of you who heard RDF probably also heard RDF triples. Okay, that's because it's a binary predicate. In a binary predicate, you have the predicate name, object one, object two, three things. That's why RDF triple. Okay, so Ian is an object. So in semantic web terminology, Ian is a universal resource. And there's a descriptor to it. Okay, an object is a thing with a descriptor to it. Uli is another descriptor, and then has colleague is the relation between them. Okay, now so the URIs, basically there's a way of giving, you know, just as page can have an absolute URL, objects can also have URIs, which is just a generalized form of URL. Okay, so like RDF, in RDF URIs typically look like normal URLs, often with fragment identifiers. For example, those of you who have done any HTML know that you can, for example, write a little section name for some particular part of the HTML file, and and then you can say the entire URL hash section name, and then the browser would not only go to that page, but we'll put that section name at the top of the browser page, for example. Okay, so you could actually provide URLs with the fragment identifiers as to where that object is living in that file. Okay, so here is syntax. You know, I've told you that RDF is just an XML syntax for writing base facts. Okay, and this is it. Now, you could go the opposite way. You could start from here and then start getting confused about, you know, what are all these tags? You need some tag to talk about the URIs and the predicates and so on. The question is, which ones did they pick in this case? So here, you know, there are the descriptions about URI1, URI2, and the relation. Okay, so it has an XML syntax, and the specific meaning, by the way, RDF has XML syntax that has specific meaning. Who carries that meaning? It's all the people who write RDF. Okay, if you know, for example, I can say this sign has a specific meaning. It has a specific meaning for all English-speaking people. Okay, this sign, I don't even know how to write this, doesn't have much of a meaning for English-speaking people, but for Spanish, I think this one has a meaning. Okay, so the meaning is agreed upon by all the people who are writing the RDF triples. Okay, so that then a program which then you can then write a single program or a single sequence of programs that essentially can process RDF data, because they all can read off using the same sort of syntax, and then it becomes a simple database problem. If you just have base facts, and if your queries are only over base facts, okay, remember in the Ramayana thing, if your queries are all on the base facts, then I would argue at this level of querying, this level of querying is IR. This level of querying is databases, just simple databases. This level of querying is logic. So from the database side, it can be thought of as data log, deductive databases, or you can just think of as first order logic. Okay, so to answer these queries, you need database style query processing. So you can write that because RDF can be read in, and then you support database style query processing. Okay, so actually going from here to here is considered writing a database, you know, using text to populate a database. And in, as I said, you know, RDF is the human way of doing it. The other way of doing it is information extraction. Okay, I don't know whether you noticed this or not. I said for going from here to here, either you can go by humans, which will do semantic web, or do information extraction, which I'll talk to you about, you know, towards the end of today's class and tomorrow. But I didn't say anything about how to go from here to here directly by extraction, some automated way. Because reading text to figure out how the world works, that is an AI complete problem. Okay, that means basically that means you need to know all the things that people know to be able to just read text and figure all these patterns in the world out. That's a much, much harder problem. So most information extraction tries to go from here to here, not from here to there. Okay, it's because it's too hard. You can't support it. Okay. So that's RDF example, okay? I mean, these things can look really ugly. I mean, you write, this could be written much more simply for you and me as Hal's colleague, Ian Uli. And that looks much simpler to understand. But it's not, you are not the intended audience for this description. It's the RDF processing programs, and they need an unambiguous syntax. And this is one. Okay, so you now have sort of a nice object descriptive, you know, if you think in terms of this bunch of RDF statements in a particular file, then it is essentially providing connections between objects. The relation names connect objects, and the objects are URIs. Each RDF triple puts a link between two objects using a relation name. Okay, and then you can write database style query processing on this, for example. Okay, again, as I said, this was kind of connected to that question that you were asking earlier. How do I know whether having colleague is transitive or not transitive? So if Ian has Uli as a colleague and Uli has Carol as a colleague, then is Ian a colleague of Carol or not? If you ask me right now, no, because only the base facts are there, and these base facts say this and these are colleagues, this and these are colleagues, nothing more. To be able to say this is a colleague of this, you need extra background knowledge, saying colleagueness is transitive. If you believe that, then you have to write that. Then you will be able to infer that this and this and this are colleagues. Okay? So, as I said, if you are looking at the RDF standard, a couple of things that you can kind of bitch about RDF is that it only uses binary properties because it's in terms of triples. Okay? Now, it turns out, what if I want to talk about X is a referee of the chess game between Y and Z? That's a base fact. How do I represent that? Is that a big problem given that RDF triples are only binary relations? No, because I get to make up essentially there's an idea in logic called reification. Reification is to make something into an object, make a higher level relation in itself into an object. Okay? So I can essentially make chess game itself an object and say this particular chess game has player 1 X, I mean player 1 Y, player 2 Z, and a referee is X. Okay, so that's exactly what I'm saying here. So chess game has been reified into an object. Okay, and this particular chess game has a referee X, player 1 Y, player 2 Z. All I'm saying is you can write whatever you have in this format. Binary relationships are not killing expressiveness. Any NRE relationship can be written down as a binary relation, as a set of binary relations. Okay, it may not be natural, but it can be done. So in some sense, you now have made up an extra object called chess game 5. And chess game 5 happened to be conducted between player 1 and player 2, Y and Z, and that particular game's referee was X. Okay? So the other interesting, you can also talk about other interesting things about whether RDF is a reasonable standard. In the sense, once you decide that you need a syntax for representing base facts, is RDF the right fit? One is, as I said, it sort of sticks to binary predicates. But the other is also that for the amount of work it's actually trying to do, it's way too sophisticated because it allows this kind of reification, which basically makes a chess game into an object. Okay, so people from the logic side, people who are spending time in terms of tractability of logics, inference techniques in logics, and so on, say RDF is too much and too little for the specific problem that it's trying to solve. But a standard is one for which people hate it, people love it, but it's a standard. Enough people use it, it's a standard. Right? I mean, English has become a standard right now. I mean, there are lots and lots of problems with the language. Okay? But it doesn't matter. We all decided to go with it. Okay? Okay, so basically this one is saying that reification is a little too sophisticated for, what RDF is trying to do, which doesn't even involve writing the full background knowledge. Okay? Now, the next part is RDF schema, which actually, for the case of RDF, I showed you the syntax at least. Syntax, okay, in XML syntax. RDF schema, I won't even show it to you. Okay, you can go and find out because I don't quite know how much you got from this other than believing that there must be some syntax. I'm just not making it up. If you go, you will find the exact reference manual for RDF somewhere, which will tell you how to write RDF triples. Okay? For the background knowledge writing, okay, essentially, again, it's the same story. Just as in Ramayana, there is base facts, and you may want to write facts in the background knowledge. Those are written in a different standard you know, originally it used to be RDF schema, but now it's a generalized version of RDF schema called AUG. Okay, and an example of what it does, essentially RDF schema does, as I said, is it provides class-subclass relationships. Okay, that's a way of saying, so for example, when I wrote in the Ramayana example, when I wrote parent of son of XY implies parent of XY, I'm basically saying the class parent of XY subsumes the class son of XY. I'm sorry, this is actually YX, I guess. Yeah. Okay? You can think in terms of the universe of two objects, the object pairs for which the parent relation holds, the object pairs for which the son of relation holds is a subset of that. It's a subclass. Okay? So you can write this in terms of this class subclass relation, and when you write class subclass relation, one other way of thinking about it is this is a hierarchy. Okay, so for example, human X is a mammal X. Mammal X is animal X. Animal X is a living thing X. Living thing X is a thing X. Right? Now, when I write this kind of a hierarchy, all I'm saying is this is a class subclass relation. Mammals subsume humans, animals subsume mammals, living things subsume animals, and so on. Okay? And this, because you can write these kinds of hierarchies normally tend to be thought of as ontologies, and in essence, what RDF schema states as background knowledge has been called ontologies. Okay, but it's a better idea to think of what RDF schema states as what AUL states as background knowledge, over and above the base facts. Okay, so for our example, let's say, suppose I have an RDF triple saying discrete mathematics is taught by David Billington. That's an RDF triple. It's a base fact. Okay. Now, on top of this, I might want to say the following thing. That's background knowledge. So, it's now saying here is a larger ontology, larger amount of background relations about what is taught by means, what discrete mathematics is, what David Billington is. Okay, so for example, this one it says discrete mathematics is of type course and is taught by relation. David Billington is of type associate professor. Okay, and then in the background knowledge I'm getting to state that associate professors, really this thing existed even when this file didn't exist. This is some sort of background knowledge about how universities work. All I needed to do is plug my base knowledge into that, and I can do all sorts of interesting inferences. That's what you did for the Magellan example. Okay, so I get to state in this particular case that the course is basically, you know, course is involves, requires, you know, is taught by, and that is taught by relation has domain course and range one of the people who are allowed to teach it. And the only people who are allowed to teach courses according to this is objects of type academic staff members. And objects of type academic staff members have subclasses, professor, associate professor, assistant professor. Of course, you know, lecturers and all that stuff can be thrown into, but that's right now that's what is said here. Okay, now academic staff member itself is a subclass of staff member. Okay, and similarly, in essence, this description, for example, this is that of a meta description about this relation. So there is some reason to think of this as providing the schema for this relation. The E-start by relation can only hold between objects of type courses and objects of type academic staff members. And so if you have a base fact, then it better be the case that this belongs to the object of type associate academic staff member, and this belongs to the type course. Now, if you want to write this knowledge, that's what you would write in RDF schema or OWL. Okay? There is enough vocabulary out there, enough syntax out there to be able to state this kind of class, subclass relations, and restrictions on what domains and ranges the URIs can have when they become arguments to a predicate. Okay? So that, you know, once you write this, then, you know, you, as long as you threw in a bunch of base facts, let's say, all you need to do is make statements about how those base facts plug into this ontology. And then you can support logical inference. Okay? We can go into a lot of interesting discussions from a logical side, from a first order logic side, as to whether or not this is the right amount of inference. That is it expressive enough representation that everything you know about the world can be written this way? Okay, but I would not do it because I'm not quite sure how many of you actually have large background or, you know, background in expressiveness. There are some slides here that you might read, and the basic, this is actually a particularly useful slide. The basic point is that essentially semantic web folks just made a particular engineering decision as to thou shalt have only this much expressiveness in writing the background knowledge. Why? Because if all your background knowledge can be written in this sort of a form, then even though normal first order logical reasoning, as I said, is semi-decidable, anything that you can say in this form, inference over it turns out to be tractable. Okay? Now, that's like saying, for those of you who have some background in logic, you know, especially the couple of you who may have done either logic course or 471, that's like saying, you might remember from the intro to AI courses that every logical sentence can be written into a canonical form called clauses. Okay? A clause essentially is of the form P of XY R not K of YZ R J of XZ. That's a clause. A clause essentially is an, it's a literal. A literal is an atom or the negation of the atom. An atom is a relation with its arguments. Now it turns out that since every logical sentence can be written into a clausal form, converting logical sentences to clausal form doesn't reduce the complexity of reasoning with it. However, when you write it into the clausal form, if the clauses happen to have something called Hahn clause syntax, that means they have at most one positive literal. Is this a Hahn clause syntax? Is this a Hahn clause? At most one positive literal. No, this is not Hahn clause because it has two positive literals. If everything you know happens to be of the form which, when converted into clausal form, has at most one positive literal, then basically your knowledge will be of the form A of X and B of Y implies P of Z. A bunch of implications. And if you have a bunch of implications, all the inferences you can do can be done by chaining these implications. And in that particular case, inference would be polynomial, even though for the full first order logic, inference is semi-decidable. Now, the question that this particular slide is trying to bring up, and you can think about it once you go home, is if my program doesn't want to do more than a polynomial amount of reasoning, okay, should I first hit you on the head until you change the problem such that I can solve it in polynomial amount of time? Or should I let you say what you want to say and I'll only do polynomial amount of reasoning on what you gave me? In the first case, I get to say with respect to the input I'm given, I'm complete. Everything that can be inferred was inferred from what is given to me. But I really actually kept hitting you on the head until you removed all the offending statements from the background knowledge. In the second case, I allowed you to write whatever you wanted, and then I kept improving my program such that hopefully it will be able to get more and more inferences out of the background knowledge. These are two different views of knowledge representation. One which says the human should give only the knowledge that the machines can, you know, deal with in polynomial time. The other which says let the human give whatever they want to give and you just try to run with, you know, do as much inference as you can, so that sometimes you may not be able to actually prove theorems that are actually true in the language, but you are unable to prove it because your inference mechanism is not strong enough. Okay, among these two views, semantic web can be seen as hitting people on the head until they wrote whatever they know about the world in this stunted form. Do you understand what I'm saying? And then, of course, reasoning over that is actually polynomial. And so some people within the semantic web community will be saying, you know, no, maybe we should actually allow RDF schema to be more fully first order. And even now there are papers about expressiveness versus tractability of semantic web standards, which are really nothing but a new version of expressiveness versus tractability problems, challenges in logic, general logic representation. Yes, sir.
What is, I mean, suppose if I'm hosting a website, what is the benefit I would get if I make my web semantically readable?
Mm-hmm.
What's the benefit I would get if my...
That's a very good question. I mean, I don't know. I mean, maybe Tim Berners-Lee will say this guy is a good guy. No, that's about it. You know, the reality is, so, okay, let me get to that question, which is, this is the thinking feeling about semantic web in general. The thinking feeling about semantic web is, here are standards waiting to be used. And naysayers like this guy are saying, why should I use that standard? Okay, I mean, if I use this standard, somebody else can do better query processing, but what's it to me? And there should be some way of saying there is something to this guy so that he would learn RDF and write it. If you can't convince him, I mean, then this is like a retail politics. You have to convince him, you have to convince this guy who is staring at his laptop, to convince those two people who are talking to each other, and all of them get convinced and then write everything in RDF. That's too hard. Then you might say, I'll write a C program, which will take his page, convert it into RDF format. That would be information extraction. Okay, computer scientists obviously are sociopaths. They don't really like people, right? right. So a way of avoiding talking to people is writing programs such that we don't have to talk to people. That's a good thing. Okay, so but that's a very good question. You have to keep this in mind. But I have to bring up, you know, I might have my opinions as to which might win over in the end, but I have to tell you both, because both these fields are hale and healthy. If you look at dub, after this class, you go back and look at the proceedings, there are papers on information extraction, there are papers on semantic web. Okay, and you need to understand what they're talking about. Before you can say somebody is foolish, you need to understand what foolish thing are they doing. Okay, I'm not saying who is foolish here, but you know, you have to understand, you know, the points here. Okay, so intended use of semantic web, one is this. This is one of the guys who is behind this sort of stuff, and so he has his page which is meant for human machines. And if you say view source on it, normally view source only shows HTML coding, right? But in this particular case, if you look carefully, it will also say things like use the ontology here, okay, and then it writes base facts that will be found in this page somewhere. This is exactly what I meant. I'll write Ramayana in English and I'll write, you know, a bunch of extra stuff on the top which would be machine readable. Okay, so that they can, you can both support IR style querying and support database style querying given these pages. Okay, one huge big thing in as we go forward in search is answering in aggregate. Remember that all search engines, when asked, do you have time, will show you a place where you might be able to find time. They will not give you answers. They will give you pointers where the answers can be found. If you have aggregate questions, such as what are the average number of people, average number of spouses for the heroes in Ramayana, that's a reasonable question. You may not want to ask every day, but if you did ask, currently, Google says, here are all the pages where the word Ramayana occurs. You do your homework. Okay? But now we want to be able to support those two. Okay, so this is one intended use. The other intended use is what I mentioned last time when I started talking about semantic web, which is, suppose people directly wrote their databases in RDF triples. Okay, remember, what's a database? A relational database is an NRE, you know, each tuple in a table is an NRE relation with arguments. Yes? Okay? And I told you that you can convert every NRE relation into a set of binary relations. And if you do that, then you have a bunch of RDF triples corresponding to that NRE relation. Okay? So you can compile a database down into a set of RDF triples. That's exactly what these two databases did. Here is RDF triple, and here is an RDF triple, except the only problem is they were using different relation names. And then using the RDF schema, in this particular case, OWL, I was able to state the background knowledge saying SLR is nothing but a camera. And that f-stop is nothing but, somewhere else I said f-stop is nothing but f-stop is nothing but lens size. I just said that in the background. And now with this, I can integrate these databases in a true way. Now I will be able to give you all cameras which have a certain property. Even if they wound up calling one guy, even if the query is in terms of SLR, I will still be able to use the camera tuples. Even if the query is only in terms of camera, I'll still be able to use SLR tuples. That's another intended use of semantic web. And this might actually come to fruition faster because this assumes there are a bunch of people who are trying to sell stuff, but they haven't yet completely agreed on a single vocabulary. They may be having like three or four different vocabularies, and there's some background knowledge combining these vocabularies, mapping these vocabularies onto each other. Okay? Currently, those are the main uses of semantic web, and this is the background of the standards in the semantic web. Okay. Now, the big question, of course, semantic web, and that gets us into information extraction for the next 15 minutes, and we'll continue tomorrow, is who's going to sit down and write everything in RDF format? Especially if you are like some sort of a commercial entity and all you have is a bunch of databases, like camera databases, you don't write them in English anyway. You write them in some relational format. So it's not too much of a problem for you to write it in RDF format. And it's also not hard to take a database table and convert it on the fly into a set of RDF triples. Just because RDF triples can be then put in, you know, conjunction with your background knowledge about the domains, and then you can support all sorts of interesting reasoning. Now notice that interesting reasoning doesn't come free. It takes more time. Okay? Check whether something is true in the base facts is cheaper than check if something is true transitively, because you need to do inference. But if I don't have the knowledge, I can't even do it. And you know, semantic web provides you a way of writing down the knowledge if you have it. Okay, now going back to Ramayana, this going from here to here, I said I could either do it by writing the RDF, you know, by humans, or somehow convert this directly into this. Okay, so the question is, can I sidestep the humans? Don't require the human, such as this guy who doesn't want to write these things. He thinks, I wrote this already. Why are you paying me to write some more stuff? I don't get anything out of it. You seem to get something out of it. So you should do it yourself. Okay? Then my question is, can we automatically go from here to here? Can we extract the information? Basically, when I say information, the word information is overused. Information retrieval, information extraction. And they mean completely different things. When I say information extraction, I'm going from text into base facts. That's mostly what I will end up doing. In fact, in today as well as tomorrow, for those of you, if you actually either followed information extraction literature or want to follow it, one important thing is to understand what its scope is. It turns out to be a bunch of special things that different programs do, but if you see it as going from here to here, they all fall into place. They never go from here to here, because that's much harder. They go from here to here. Okay? The question is, can I automatically do this? And if I were to try and do it automatically, that would be the quest of a subfield called information extraction. It's a very hot subfield. You know, a large number of people are pouring lots and lots of resources into information extraction, exactly because either there are legacy pages that have already been written in some natural language, and nobody is going to go and annotate them human, you know, no humans are going to spend time annotating them. Okay? Or because even if this page is being developed right now from scratch, there may be people like this guy who refuse to write anything more than what they're writing. So you can't depend on the users to provide the background the base facts. You need to extract them yourself. They just wrote it so that people can understand it. If you want machines to be able to understand it, you need to do it. Okay? That's the quest for information extraction. Yes? Possible. That's one way of thinking about it. What do you mean?
Like, for both things you need to do tokenization, for both
things. That's possible.
So, how would we club these two?
That's what I am here for. Show up tomorrow too. Okay? It'll all become very clear, especially by the time of exam. But anyway, so, this is what we are trying to do. Go from here to here. Right? That's what information extraction is trying to do. If you want a different example, here is, in fact, a bunch of slides from a tutorial by Bill Cohen and Andrew McCallum, who are two of the people who are, you know, very busy doing information extraction work. And so here is basically their view of information extraction. Given a piece of text like this, think of information extraction as filling slots in a database from subsegments of text. But that's exactly what I just said, from here to here. This is a database. Okay, so what we are basically saying is, I have told you that from this, can you tell me name, title, organization of people mentioned in this page? Okay, so an information extractor might look at this and say, Bill Gates, CEO, Microsoft, Bill Vettre, VP, Microsoft, Richard Stallman, founder, Free Software Foundation. Now, this stuff is only a subset of the information that is here. But it's in the form such that you now can answer database style queries, which you could not answer before. Again, remember what I said in the very beginning of the semester. You probably never envied databases. But it's worth envying them, because if you understand text, then you do much more than databases. But your machines, which do IR, they don't understand text. They understand keywords and how likely and less likely they are in frequencies. So they can never answer questions like, who is the CEO of Microsoft? If you want to answer it, you need to be able to take a bunch of text. I mean, either somebody wrote this as a base fact, or you take a bunch of text like this and extract these base facts. Okay? That's information extraction. So, the first question is, how can we possibly do information extraction without doing full natural language processing? Right? I mean, how can I look at text and somehow convert it into this kind of information? You know, obviously, the normal problem is that Natural language processing in general, the thing that you and I do. We can read and understand. Okay? Can you do, so is there a, so basically, if you can do full natural language processing, then this course is wasted. Lots of other courses that you have done are also wasted, by the way, but you know, this course is definitely wasted. Okay? And because if you can do this, why do you need IR? IR is poor man's NLP. Okay? And it turns out IE is a slightly middle class man's NLP. The truly rich can do NLP, and the truly rich are you guys. You can read text and understand. Okay? As we can either wait until this problem gets solved, which unfortunately has been called AI complete, in the sense it's, if it can be solved, then the idea of solving AI, that means basically developing intelligent agents which can do everything that you and I can do, is feasible. And it's no easier than the overall task of AI. That's what like NP complete, you know, it's the NP complete problems are the hardest problems in the class NP. Okay? So you can think of this, you know, in a sort of informal sense as an AI complete problem. IR is a huge relaxation of NLP. IE is a little less of a relaxation of NLP. And the reason you think IE actually might work, it turns out, and this is like the season of trying to connect it to what I said in the beginning of the semester, right? And it's, remember, web is made by people. Okay? And so there is structure to it. And they tend to write their text in such a way that there are oftentimes patterns in the text that corresponds to, you can invert those patterns and get the base facts. So one way of thinking about it is, when somebody wrote this text, they wanted to give you a bunch of facts. Whether this is true or not, this is a conceptual view. The person who wrote this text wanted to convey to you a bunch of facts about the world. They converted them into this format. Now you're trying to invert that. They converted into this format because they thought you don't like this format. They thought you, the human, doesn't like this format. But now you're saying, I want my program also to understand. And my program, unfortunately, doesn't understand this format unless I keep telling it this stuff. Okay? So IE essentially is hoping that the way the translation occurred into text has enough of a regularity that even though full NLP is horrendously complex, some simple kinds of extraction, such as extracting entities, extracting relationships, which is just a base fact from the text, is not too hard. That's what IE is hoping. And it turns out that there are a whole bunch of techniques, a whole spectrum of techniques for doing information extraction, some which are more, you know, more efficient, more effective than others, some which do more processing, more assumptions on the text format. And for the next several slides, starting today and continuing tomorrow, I'll try to get you to understand the spectrum of information extraction tasks. And then we'll spend some time understanding at least a couple of simple techniques. My bigger issue in the last class as well as this class is, I want you to be able to understand what semantic web is, so that if you read a paper, you know where, how to pigeonhole it, how to peg it. And if you read a IE paper, you may not be able to understand the specific technique they are using, but you should be able to peg it as to, you know, how does it correspond to IE and IR, information retrieval, semantic web, and which particular part of, type of information extraction is it trying to do. Okay? So the answer is really because the web is made by humans who tend to more or less follow reasonable, I mean, there is some reasonable pattern to the way the facts were converted into English. And you can invert it sometimes. And this assumption is more true in some cases than other cases. This assumption turns out to be like 100% true for a whole bunch of cases where the web really has a database backend. Okay, how many people think that the web has web pages, as against web has databases which generate the page in some pseudo-English on demand? If you make a page, you probably wrote it in English, okay, or whatever natural language. It turns out that more than 90% of the web, depending on, you know, different people's, you know, estimates, is what is called deep web, which is essentially a whole bunch of mind-numbing knowledge about this product costs this much, this country's capital is this, a whole bunch of base facts that have already been put in databases. But the databases previously were only being used by people who knew SQL. Now they heard that all of you guys are actually, you know, doing search. And so they want to provide a little front end on the web so that you can query the databases. Okay? In fact, a couple of years back, I think last year, the last time I was teaching this course, there was this big hue and cry about the fact that governments now are allowing their databases to be queried through Google. And this was obviously power to the people, right? Because you get to see whether or not they have FBI files on you, right? Those databases exist already, and they could have just given the knowledge of those tuples. Those tuples could have been written down in the normal tuple fashion, you know, colon, colon, colon. But they think humans are asking this question, so they take the trouble to take a database tuple and convert it into pseudo-English. That means highly structured English. So in that case, converting it back into tuples is extremely easy. Okay? So for example, if I have a database of countries and their capitals, and I query that database, it answers me questions like, the capital of India is New Delhi. Okay? And obviously, it pats itself on the back saying, I spoke in English. And if you say, I want to hear the same thing in Telugu, it will say the same thing in Telugu. Okay? Supposedly, it's trying to impress you. But if what you wanted was to download its database, then you need to undo this transformation. The thing that it did to help you, you want to reverse it so that you'll get back, you know, so the ability to go from the capital of India is New Delhi. Okay, so cut, take India, cut, take the next word, and now put this as country, city, and into the capital database. This is information extraction. This particular case of information extraction is what is called wrapper learning, because in fact it should be unwrapper learning, but it's called wrapper learning, because the idea is the database thought you can be more impressed if it were to wrap its structured tuple into some kind of pidgin English. You on the other hand wished the database didn't do it. Okay, either you have an API directly into the database, in which case it will just send you the tuples in some XML format, or if you don't have an agreement with the database, then you have to go from the file, a text file, which it generated for normal human consumption, into the database format, which is undoing this translation. That's a very simple form of information extraction. The earliest forms of information extraction really basically learned this kind of pattern. If I give you a whole bunch of sentences and how they get unwrapped, you learn the pattern. Either you learn the pattern or you just take the pattern. Okay? So what I'll do starting next class is essentially is to go into the spectrum of information extraction approaches and how, you know, what assumptions they make. And I want to leave you with a last thought, which is, if you were to unwrap, if you were to do information extraction, would it be impressing anybody? And here are a bunch of examples of sites that you use every day which are using information extraction. Okay? So one is Google Scholar, as I told you, you know, I like papers and people citing me. So there is Google Scholar. It tells me which papers of mine are being cited by people. Now, they never wrote in a database that we are citing this paper. they just have their own papers, you know, in PDF format. And essentially, you need to read this PDF format, and basically, which is sort of, you know, can convert easily enough into text file. But then from the text file, you should be able to learn the citations. You should be able to say that two different citations are actually to the same paper, for example, so that you can count the numbers. Okay? And then, let's see. So, if you can do this, in fact, here is one more thing, you know, obviously this is quite narcissistic, but this is a version, a front-end over Google Scholar, or actually, you know, Microsoft Academic Earth, where it can tell you the universe of a particular author. So, you know, you can click on a particular author, it will tell you who are all the people they wrote papers with, and how far are they, in some sense, both chronologically and in terms of number of papers. These are kinds of things you can do easily from single PDF files.
Are there different colors, different departments?
I don't remember. They may be strength. Okay. But it also, because it's information extraction, sometimes the extraction could be failing. Sometimes the extraction can be failing. It turns out that this paper, the first author for this paper is me. But when Google Scholar decided to extract the authors, they didn't like my name. So they just removed me. And I told you an equivalent story of Jim Handler previously. Right? And so anyway, so I was just trying to even prove it to you. That's a different story. But here is one last thing, which is the one of the first companies to make big bucks in this area was, remember I said it's a jungle out there, and it turns out there was a company called Jungly. Okay, and Jungly was bought by Amazon at the height of internet bubble. What did Jungly do? Jungly essentially said, we will basically look at all the employment ads from different papers, put them in a single database so that you can ask pretty strong queries about those employment ads. Right now, this was 10 years back. Now, actually, these kinds of services are available. You know, I think GoDaddy does that, apart from the Super Bowl ads, and then Monster.com does that. But, you know, the point is, if you can convert all of these into one single format, even when people were using different formats, and put them in a database of employment opportunities, then you can allow people to ask pretty complex queries. You know, give me a job which pays me more than $100,000, allows me to take 5 days a week, you know, off to go, you know, sailing, and, you know, and all sorts of fun stuff. And you can ask these kinds of questions to this database. All they did was essentially they wrote manual unwrapping programs. So they would write a single unwrapper for New York Times, single unwrapper from Chicago Tribune, single unwrapper for Washington Post, and they'll hire people from this course to actually keep paying attention to see if New York Times changed its format. If so, you change the unwrapper. And you get good money and you don't complain. So this is the new version of rote work. And they were essentially just doing this, and they got bought over for multi-million dollars from Amazon. And Amazon obviously supports a lot of extraction because that's how it does various recommendation systems and so on. Okay? We'll come back next class, which is tomorrow, and then talk more about information extraction.